Greetings once again from Denver, Colorado, the city right here in the middle of it all. You may have heard the news, but stand by now for the worldview. That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview. I am your host, Doug McBurney. So glad to have you back with us. The broadcast, the show of all shows where we take the events of the week and we focus them through the lens of original thought. I'm going to dive right in. I have, this week I want to start in the domestic tranquility file because I feel like it's been getting short shrift in some of the more recent broadcasts. And so, what's this? Hot off the presses? Okay. Hot off the presses. No, I'll do it. I don't like being handed a story without the opportunity to look at it, necessarily. But the headline, I must say, is quite intriguing. Ronnie Wood accused of domestic assault. Ronnie Wood, legendary Rolling Stones. But what is he, a bass player? I think he's a bass player, or at least he was, back when the Rolling Stones were alive. Ronnie Wood accused of domestic assault. Rolling Stone guitarist Ronnie Wood was released on bail last Thursday after being arrested on suspicion of assaulting a 20-year-old girl. What? Did this scumbag beat up his granddaughter? What is this? The 62-year-old was arrested near his home in southern England last Wednesday. He spent the night in police custody. Wood has reportedly been dating a 20-year-old Russian cocktail waitress, Ekaterina Ivanova. No, that's not Tiger Woods' girlfriend. This is Ronnie Wood's girlfriend. It's a different fellow altogether. Okay, well, apparently, what more can you say about that? It wasn't his granddaughter after all. But I do want to jump in now to get serious here. I don't appreciate being thrown off track so early in the broadcast, by the way. All right, now to get to the... Now, you'll have to forgive my frogginess of throat. I've spent the last several days out speaking with, witnessing upon the unwashed masses out at the Denver's Parade of Lights, which is just... It's a wonderful family event, except for the fact that it was 9 degrees. Other than that, it was great. But I spent... I don't know, but maybe a total of about 5 hours over 2 nights, getting there just before sundown, and as the temperature descended 15 to 20 degrees per hour, I walked up and down the street with my personhood initiative petition, asking people to sign the pro-life petition. And, I had an incident. It was a minor incident, okay? There were no arrests. I did not spend the night in jail. But I had an incident with a 15-year-old kid and his dad. Now, I'm walking along as peaceful as can be, and I've got my personhood petition. And I'm asking people if they're pro-life, would you like to sign the pro-life petition? And this 15-year-old kid stumbles past me, and he says, "Pro-life, huh? What's that, man? Is that for, like, legalizing pot?" Right? And so I was in my most lamb-like mode, just trying to be sensitive and loving. And so I hesitated for a moment as the kid stumbled past me over to standing next to a fellow who looked like his dad. And his dad smelled like a gin mill. And he kind of ambled there up next to his dad and gave me this smirk. And I leaned over real close to the little punk's face. And I said, "Young man, one day you will stand before the living God of the universe and you will give an account for every idle word that passes your lips." Now he looked at me with utter confusion. And in an instant, I realized that it wasn't that he didn't understand the context of the scripture verse that I was quoting to him. It was that he didn't understand that many words with that many syllables all strung into one sentence. He literally didn't understand what I had said. And so I reiterated. I said, young man, God is going to want to know from you why you made such smart aleck comments to a Christian guy out on the street trying to save kids and trying to change hearts and minds about our attitude toward the weakest among us. At which point his dad got very upset with me, told me to leave his boy alone. And so I did. I left him alone. I wandered on down the street and gathered signatures from those in the audience there, the masses, who could understand multisyllabic words. And a good time was had by all. I'm hoping that the young man did comprehend that he is going to be judged for every stupid thing he said. I hope I got that across to the young dimwit and his inebriated father. But anyways, I was telling you that by way of explaining why I sound a little raggedy of the vocal pipes today, because it was rough out there. All right, now, into the domestic tranquility file we go. Dateline, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Oddly enough, from WKMG-TV in Orlando, a report out of Philadelphia, a trio of homeless drug addicts stole a watch from a school counselor who died in the emergency room after suffering an apparent heart attack. Now, Joaquin Rivera, 63-year-old gentleman, died in a Philadelphia emergency room after waiting nearly 80 minutes for help before he could see a triage nurse. Now, we haven't even socialized healthcare all the way yet, and this poor slob's waiting 80 minutes and dies right there in the emergency room. But that's not the worst of it. Based on witness accounts, police say that Rivera passed out, and security video shows a man stealing his watch and passing it to another man. So they're robbing bodies, dead bodies, in the emergency rooms as they languish waiting for health care in the city of brotherly love. That's the state of domestic tranquility there in Philadelphia. And quite sad indeed. Now, from Madison, Wisconsin, from the Associated Press, police believe the fatal shootings of a mother and her young daughter in Madison, Wisconsin, were connected to the slayings of another woman and a young girl in the nearby suburbs. Authorities were searching, as we went to air today, for a person of interest in all four deaths. Tyrone Adair, 38-year-old fellow, is the person of interest. Adair had a relationship with both women, found dead last Thursday. Court records indicate that Tyrone Adair was involved in paternity cases with a woman in the same block as the Madison double homicide and a paternity case with a woman in the suburb of Middleton. Wow. So another multiple killing, a slaughter, a bloodbath in Wisconsin that can be traced directly to sexual immorality, which has been decriminalized and is tolerated throughout the land. And it leads to more bloodshed than any of the dread diseases that we're hearing about. It leads to more death than a lack of proper insurance or health care amongst the poor. It's sexual immorality that is an epidemic, and it's causing an epidemic of violence, murder. But I think I've stated that on more than one occasion, and I'm sure you understand that I am correct. Dateline North Versailles, Pennsylvania, a 72-year-old Walmart greeter was punched in the face outside his store and had to go to the hospital. Police say the attack appears to have been unprovoked. 55-year-old Paul Washington of North Versailles was arrested and charged with assault, public drunkenness, and other counts. Washington denies hitting 72-year-old Thomas Jenkins, despite video footage. So they have him on videotape punching the 72-year-old, yet he denies it, and he will be allowed to enter a plea of not guilty, and the judge will sit there with a straight face. And he'll Jenkins was treated in the hospital for broken facial bones. A poor bell ringer. No, not even a bell ringer. This is just a Walmart greeter. This is like a retired guy making minimum wage, just doing something so he can keep his blood pumping every day. Going down to Walmart, greeting people at the door, pushing a cart in front of you. Guy slugs him in the face. Domestic tranquility wanes in North Versailles, Pennsylvania. Dateline, Indianapolis, Indiana. This is a tough one. 17-year-old Andrew Conley of Rising Sun, Indiana, was calm and showed no remorse or emotion as he described strangling his 10-year-old brother, Connor, as the two wrestled last Sunday. Conley told investigators he dumped his brother's dead body near a park in the Ohio River community about 90 miles southeast of Indianapolis. Prosecutors have charged 17-year-old Andrew with murder. He is being charged as an adult. The 17-year-old teen told investigators he had had fantasies about killing someone since he was in eighth grade. He said killing his brother satisfied a craving like a hamburger satisfies hunger. This slaying, you'll recall, comes 6 weeks after 15-year-old Alyssa Bustamante told Missouri authorities she strangled, stabbed, and cut a 9-year-old neighbor's throat because she wanted to, quote, know what it was like to kill someone. 17-year-old Andrew Conley in Indiana killed his brother before visiting his girlfriend and other friends. He told investigators his 10-year-old brother's last words were, Andrew, stop. Wow. Now, I remember telling my brother to stop. My brother was bigger than me, and he used to beat me up. He used to pin me down. Here's what my brother used to do. Okay, now I hope my mom and dad aren't listening because they may not be aware of how horrible my upbringing was, my childhood. My brother used to pin me down on the floor. He pinned my shoulders down with his knees, and he would then drip spittle down, and it would drip close to my face, and then he would suck it back up into his mouth. I know, it's horrible, isn't it? What a horrible childhood I have. It's no wonder I turned out so messed up. Anyways, and sometimes he wouldn't suck it back up in time, and it would drip down on me. It was awful. Just awful. But that was the extent of that type of thing back in the 1970s, early 80s. But now, I mean, I don't know what's going on with young people. Here's a 17-year-old strangling his 10-year-old brother just to satisfy a craving he had to kill someone. It's, man. Anyway, just horrible. Okay, I'm through the domestic tranquility file. Dateline Sonoma, California. Police in Sonoma found the home of Jonathan and Susan Maloney ransacked last Tuesday with valuables and a vehicle missing. It appears burglars spent a considerable amount of time going through the family's possessions. The couple, Jonathan and Susan Maloney, and their two young children were killed the previous Saturday when a car struck their minivan as they were returning from a trip to Hawaii. That's a state of domestic tranquility out in beautiful Northern California, Sonoma, wine country. Dateline Riverhead, New York. One of six remaining defendants awaiting trial in the fatal stabbing of an Ecuadorian immigrant in New York has pleaded guilty to gang assault as a hate crime. And I guess that's the official charge, gang assault as a hate crime. Now, the Ecuadorian immigrant was killed. So I hope there's a murder charge in here somewhere. Let's read on. Jose Pacheco agreed Wednesday to testify against other defendants accused in the death of dry cleaning worker Marcelo Lucero. Lucero was stabbed in the chest back on November 8th in Pachog, New York. Authorities say seven teens went looking for a Latino victim. Lucero was stabbed on November 8th of 2008. And the government is still working to make a deal with the killers, playing Let's Make a Deal a year later. The Associated Press story says, "The year since Lucero's slaying has put a national spotlight on the area's race relations. The U.S. Justice Department launched a probe of hate crimes and police responses to them." Launched a probe? The U.S. Justice Department launched a probe? What are you, NASA? These aren't strange new worlds. You don't need to launch a probe. These are murderers. Charges should be brought, trials should be held, and heads should roll. There should be executions. Forget about launching probes. How about administering justice there in upstate New York? Finally, from the domestic tranquility file, Topeka, Kansas. A weekend shooting left a granddaughter. Wow. An elderly woman has died from injuries suffered in a weekend shooting in northeast Kansas that also left her granddaughter and two great-granddaughters dead. 89-year-old Dorothy White of Osage County died in the hospital last Tuesday. 46-year-old James Craig Kaler is charged with capital murder in the deaths of his 44-year-old estranged wife Karen and their daughters, 18-year-old Emily, 16-year-old Lauren. Dorothy White was Karen Kaler's grandmother. This is Topeka, Kansas. This is not Waziristan or the border area between Pakistan and Afghanistan. This is not Baghdad. This is not Al-Anbar province. Well, we've got to wonder what were the framers of the Constitution thinking about when they entrusted the government to ensure domestic tranquility? Were they concerned about Waziristan or Topeka? Worldview. I'm Doug McBurney, and we have gotten through the domestic tranquility file, and a sad one it was this week. And that's just a sampling of the slaughter and bloodshed that goes on a daily basis here in the freest post-Christian nation on the planet. And it's just hard to deal with. All right. So let's go from the domestic tranquility file into the justice file. Can we start with some good news? Do I have any good news? Let's see from the justice file. Here we go. We'll start with some good news in the justice file because I don't want you to get too depressed out there. Dateline Huntsville, Texas, where we go so often for good news in the justice file. Bobby Wayne Woods, a 44-year-old Texas man, received lethal injection about a half hour after the Supreme Court refused to halt his punishment. His lawyers had argued that Woods was mentally impaired, making him ineligible for execution, and that previous appeals to spare his life were unsuccessful because of shoddy work by his ignorant, stupid, bumbling lawyers. So you've got one group of lawyers, possibly the same lawyers that tried to defend the guy in the first place, saying that, well, his lawyers were idiots. They were obviously coked-up freaks, and they didn't know what was going on. They barely showed up. They were late. They were incompetent buffoons. We can't believe you allowed them to pass the board. But the governor down in Texas didn't buy it, and they did put this 44-year-old murderer to death. Now, let's see. Woods, 44-year-old Bobby Wayne Woods, was convicted of capital murder and sentenced to die for the April 1997 slaying of Sarah Patterson, his ex-girlfriend's daughter. Sarah's throat was slit with a knife. Her brother was beaten and left for dead, but he survived to testify against this poor, mentally challenged Bobby Wayne Woods, this poor boy. This poor, mentally impaired boy who murdered a woman some 12 years ago. Let's see. Asked if he had a final statement. Woods replied, "Bye, I'm ready." Well, maybe he's not the sharpest tool in the box, but he certainly sounds like he understood what was going on. I mean, he said goodbye. How mentally impaired could he be? Could he have been? 8 minutes after he said bye-bye, he was pronounced dead. Yes. Was he ready? Well, I mean, seeing as it was 12 years since he committed his crime until he was punished appropriately with the death penalty, my guess is he was not ready. Now, we've got a quote from Larry Patterson, who was the father of the victim. Young Sarah Patterson, murdered. Well, her father said, "I'm not a person that likes harm done to anybody, but I believe in justice being done." Well, that's good. I'm sure he wanted to do it himself, if he's a normal father. All right, so on into the justice file. That's the good news for the day. Here we go. Dateline Corsicana, Texas. David Martin, who was a defense attorney who represented one Cameron Todd Willingham at trial, he says he's sickened by the suggestion that Texas executed an innocent man when one Cameron Todd Willingham was put to death for setting a fire that killed his three children. You'll remember we have covered this story in the past, rather, well, fairly significantly. Well, his defense attorney says he has no doubt that his client deserved to die. Martin said, quote, "I think that he was guilty and he deserved death and that he got death," unquote. Let's see. Fire investigation experts who were hired first by the Innocence Project and later by the Texas Forensic Science Commission concluded the original finding of arson was seriously flawed. That's right. You'll remember this fellow was convicted of setting a fire that killed his children. And now the Innocence Project comes along many years later, you know, looking at just documents and they say, well, there was problems here. Now, without that finding, according to this Associated Press story, prosecutors have admitted it would have been hard to win a death sentence against Cameron Todd Willingham. So understand this, ladies and gentlemen, the folks at the Innocence Project, the so-called Innocence Project, they're not even saying this guy is innocent. They're just saying that had the experts not concluded it was arson, it would have been hard to win a death sentence. So they're basically, the Innocence Project is defending a guilty man. Well, the fire investigator expert reports hired by the Innocence Project have done nothing, according to the AP article, to change the minds of Martin and four jurors that the Associated Press was able to reach. They say they believe he was guilty. And let's see here. Martin, the defense attorney, says, quote, "It was really very, very clear what happened in the house. Everybody who saw it, of course, reached the same conclusion." Everyone who was at the trial, who was actually there, who was alive at the time and lived through the events, it was very clear what had happened. But that's the diabolically deceptive practice of Barry Scheck and the Scheck and Jivers over at the Innocence Project. They work day and night to free murderers, based on the review of documents, you know, and records far removed from the original context of the trial. That's their specialty over at Scheck and Jive LLC, also known as the Innocence Project. Can't wait to see them on Judgment Day. More from the justice file from Jefferson City, Missouri. The Missouri Supreme Court overturned a man's death sentence Tuesday because his attorney failed to question the character of a murder victim who had child pornography on his computer. So, did you catch all that? Well, listen to this. The High Court, that's the Missouri Supreme Court, acknowledged that character evidence about murder victims typically is barred, but when relatives of victim Ralph Lape Jr. testified about his generous character during the sentence phase of Mark Gill's murder trial, defense attorneys should have countered by highlighting the smut on Lape's computer. So because the murder victim had pornography on his computer, well, he was a scumbag. Don't get me wrong. if indeed that's true. I mean, this didn't come out in trial. We're not in a court. We're not in a court of law here. If indeed it's true that he had that on his computer, well, that has nothing to do with the fact that he was murdered by Mark Gill. Mark Gill kidnapped him and robbed him and shot him. Didn't have anything to do with what was on Lape's computer. And Mr. Gill should rightly be put to death. But the judge and the Missouri Supreme Court, in their infinite wisdom, has decided since the murder victim was a scumbag and his scumbaggedness was somehow associated with Mr. Mark Gill's character, they've decided to spare Mr. Gill's life. Now, will they put to death someone who has child pornography on their computer? No, they won't. See, that's what the court should do. Anyone in the possession of child pornography is guilty of kidnapping. Accessory to the crime, if they weren't actually involved in the videotaping. They're an accessory to the crime of kidnapping, which should carry the death penalty. But it's no longer a justice system. It's just a system. Mark Gill, plotted Lape's murder, kidnapped him, drove him to a cornfield where he was shot in the head and buried. Yeah. Anyway. They should make a case against child pornography at the Supreme Court after this scumbag's execution. Because the two are not related. All right, from Everett, Washington, the Justice File. A Washington state man has been sentenced to more than 13 years in prison in the fatal shooting of his 6-year-old daughter. Richard Peters was convicted of first-degree manslaughter in the November 16, 2008 death of Stormy Peters, his daughter. She was shot between the eyes at the family home. Prosecutors said that Richard Peters was drunk when he had Stormy get him a loaded gun from a bedroom nightstand. He says that it then discharged accidentally. Man. Awful. The Justice File is not very encouraging this week. Not very encouraging at all. Our judges and our prosecutors and our district attorneys, in order to be qualified for that job, they should have a basic understanding of what justice is and how it is to be dispensed. And that manslaughter, in the case of a drunken idiot having his daughter go get him a gun, that's negligent homicide. And the penalty should be death. And it should be public. So that anyone else out there who's getting drunk and has guns in the house will think twice about getting drunk and acting foolish with their firearms. Not only will they think twice, it would virtually never happen again, ever, if this dirtbag was put to death. But he's going to get 13 years for the price of a 6-year-old girl. Just putting a thumb in the eye of justice and ensuring the continued breakdown of domestic tranquility here in these United States. The greatest, freest, post-Christian nation on the planet. All right. One more from the Justice File. We have one more. Okay. What do we have? Dateline Nashville, Tennessee, from the Associated Press. A man who spent 28 years on death row for killing 3 people while robbing a Nashville convenience store has been executed. Now, that is good news. Good news to a certain degree. I mean, no one remembers much of the actual event. In fact, I'm sure the reporters had to go back and look at microfiche to figure out what exactly happened before 53-year-old Cecil C. Johnson Jr. was pronounced dead at 1:34 a.m. Wednesday, December 2nd, the year of our Lord. Johnson was a 23-year-old kitchen worker at a Vanderbilt hospital at the time. The victims included the market owner's son, 12-year-old Bobby Bell Jr., and 2 men sitting in a cab outside. Johnson is the 6th person put to death in Tennessee since 2000. Now, I didn't have an opportunity to look at the statistics for capital crimes in Tennessee since the year 2000, but my guess is there's been more than six. Just a wild guess. I'm willing to bet anyone any amount of money that there's been more than six. All right. Now let's move into the culture file. Well, I tell you, you start out with the domestic tranquility and the justice file, and it makes for a rather deflating show. All right. Because it's just so depressing out there to see what's happening. All right, let's go to Sacramento, California. 1 week after the Air Force adopted a strict prohibition of tattoos on the saluting arm, the new policy has been scrapped. So 1 week in, the Air Force scraps the policy. And their entire tattoo policy will be reviewed. The problem, apparently, is that some 17,000 recruits who joined under the delayed entry program were potentially affected by the ban of right arm body art. Body art? Body art? I mean, isn't that a bit of an editorial comment? Body art? I mean, it's a tattoo. Anyways, a spokesgirl for the Air Force. Have you people noticed that all of the spokespersons, it used to be that every organization had a spokesman. The police had a spokesman, the mayor had a spokesman, the army had a spokesman, the Air Force had a spokesman. Nobody has spokesmen anymore. They all have spokeswomen. I'm not sure what's going on with that, but hey, I've noticed it, and now that I've mentioned it, you're going to notice it. There's virtually no spokesman left. Men need not apply to the spokesman position. It's now held specifically by women, seemingly exclusively by women. Anyway, back to the article from News 10 in Sacramento. An Air Force spokeswoman acknowledged media coverage played a role in the decision to reconsider the tattoo crackdown. It was unfortunate, she said, that there were recruits caught in the middle. Enlistees who were not able to begin basic training this week at Lackluster Air Force Base, at Lackland Air Force Base, because of the new tattoo policy, would be rescheduled for future dates. So you got so many kids out there with like the sleeve tattoos on their arms. And these are kids joining the Air Force, for crying out loud. These are supposed to be the best and the brightest. These are the kids who made it through high school. They don't have to join the Army. They're going into the Air Force. But they were going to delay their basic training. What a tragedy. Hey, what is Air Force basic training anyways? What are they? I think they teach them eyebrow waxing and they have to go to some typing classes. Around the time that this song came out, that the tattoo explosion started to occur. It's weekends like that where you end up getting a tattoo. Anyway, I never partook of the body art myself. Even though I was in the service and there were... Body art, yeah. I was in the service and there was many an evening when me and the boys were out. And the boys decided to go down and get a bulldog with a drill instructor hat tattooed on their shoulder. And I went along for the ride, but I remember sitting outside that tattoo parlor and looking at them boys. and thinking, man, there ain't no way I'm getting that thing tattooed on my shoulder. You got to be crazy. Anyway, and one of my buddies on Facebook just put up a picture of myself and several of my Marine cohort buddies where I think three of the five of us are showing off their brand new devil dog tattoos. Yeah, it's like they're still red and they still have the Vaseline on them. And they're all like 19, 20 years old. Anyway. Now, where was I going with that? Okay. I wanted to get to this whole ClimateGate situation. We moved from tattoos and a friendly insult to my brethren in the Air Force about the perils of Air Force basic training. We'll move into ClimateGate because this is such a fun story. I've got several articles that I wanted to touch on. Apparently, from the Telegraph over in London, which, as far as I can tell, there's one London newspaper covering this story, and the rest is all blogs and right-wing radio. I shouldn't say right-wing radio. I shouldn't even say conservative radio. Republican radio. Republican radio and one newspaper are covering this story, but for the rest of the world, it's as if it never happened. It's as if no one has revealed that the progenitors of anthropogenic global warming have been cooking the books, and it's been a whole scam. It's been a total lie. It's as if it never happened. But Australia's Senate has rejected an emissions trading scheme for a second time. That's the whole cap and trade, where if you're gonna pollute, you just buy some credits from Al Gore, and you can pollute all you want. And then Al Gore takes the money that you gave him to buy those carbon credits, and he does something to clean up in the environment. And I think it involves purchasing SUVs for his mansion, or I'm not sure what Al Gore does with that money. Start liberal TV networks, hire news women and spokeswomen. I don't know what Al Gore does with the cap and trade money, but you can be assured that if you purchase your carbon credits, you don't have to feel guilty about emitting CO2, which, by the way, you do every time you exhale. So you should be feeling pretty guilty right about now if you're breathing and you haven't bought any carbon credits from Al Gore's cap and trade company. But anyway, the Australians have rejected cap and trade. The Danish, the Danes over there, carbon trading, according to the UK Telegraph, carbon trading, they say, is the emperor's new clothes of international finance. It was invented by none other than Ken Lay, whose Enron would currently be one of the prime beneficiaries in the global alternative energy market if it hadn't been shown to be nearly as fraudulent as the current anthropogenic global warming scam. So now we know why Ken Lay went to jail, because Al Gore wanted to take over his business. Yes, Enron was set to make all the money from cap and trade, and Al Gore wanted to make that dough. So that's why Ken Lay, did he die in prison or is he still alive? I just don't know. Anyway, let's see. Now, the reporter here in the Telegraph says, hats off to the Daily Express in England. They're the first British newspaper to make the global warming scam its front page story. So look at that. We've got newspaper number two getting on board. Wow. And people wonder why the newspaper is a dying industry. Newspaper number two finally becoming aware. Let's see, the BBC finally got around to reporting on the ClimateGate scam. Although he says the report on their website is so hedged with special pleading for the temporarily suspended director, Phil Jones, over in East Anglia, that Phil may have written this article himself. The BBC spends half the time in their article explaining what a great guy Phil Jones is and how wonderful he's been while he lied to the entire world about global warming. Now, the reporter here at the Telegraph says, over the next few weeks, one thing we can be absolutely certain of is concerted efforts by the rich, powerful, and influential global warming lobby to squash the ClimateGate story. We've seen this already in the nothing to see here response of Dr. Rajendra Pachauri, the jet-setting troll impersonating railway engineer who runs the IPCC and wants to stop ice being served with water in restaurants. So that's the report from the Telegraph. Some wonderful reportage going on over there, giving grist for the bloggers and the Republican radio hosts here in the United States so that someone can be reporting on this story. But let's talk about the fraud. Here's a story from the UK Daily Express that was referred to by John Ingham. He says the scientific consensus that mankind has caused climate change was rocked this past week as a leading academic called it a load of hot air underpinned by fraud. And he also said that governments were treating the public like fools and using climate change to increase taxes. Wow. Professor Pilmer, the author of Heaven and Earth, Global Warming, the Missing Science, told a London audience, climates always change. They always have, and they always will. They are driven by a number of factors that are random and cyclical. Now wait just a second. Professor Plimer, I agree with most of your assertion here that climates change, and they're driven by a number of factors. But how can you say that they're random and cyclical? I mean, something's either random or it's cyclical. And this guy's a professor, for crying out loud, and he doesn't even believe in global warming, which means he's probably one of our best and brightest professors. But he says the factors are random and cyclical. Okay, and you know, maybe you have to have an advanced degree to understand how something can be both random and cyclical simultaneously. I guess maybe I'm just not bright enough to grasp the concept. But what else does he have to say? He says the recent warming was part of the natural cycle of climate stretching over billions of years. Okay, here we go, billions of years. Okay, so this is the best we've got, ladies and gentlemen. People who, up until now, these people had bought into the global warming scam. Why? Because they were obviously stupid enough to buy into the whole evolutionary scam. You know, I'm doing a science book with my daughter, my 8-year-old, the other night, and it had a picture of the Earth with a cutaway, and it showed the Earth and the crust and the mantle and the core, and it said the core of the Earth is hot, super hot. I forget how many thousands of degrees. And she said, how could it still be hot if it's billions and billions of years old? And I said, that's a great point. You should ask one of these PhDs that question. How could the center of the Earth still be hot if it's 15 billion years old or 11 billion or 3 billion or however billion years old they say it is? Anyway, do I want to do any more from this guy? No, I don't. All right, so the best scientists we have are not that bright, okay? Let's see, Barbara Boxer says in an article at The Hill, which apparently is a magazine, or maybe it's just a website, she says leaked emails allegedly undermining climate change science should be treated as a criminal matter. A criminal matter, she says. Yeah, Barbara Boxer. Now, she doesn't say that the scam and the hoax is a criminal matter. She says stealing and revealing these emails that shows the scam is a criminal matter. She says, quote, we may well have a hearing on this. We may not. We may have a briefing for senators. We may not. Part of our looking into this will be looking at a criminal activity which could have been well coordinated. This is a crime, said Senator Barbara Boxer. That was, I think they caught her on the way into her therapist's office. She had a few words to say there. Okay, Barb, take it easy there, huh? Get back on your lithium and take it easy. Let's see here. Roger Simon and Lionel Chetwynd have called on the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences to rescind the prestigious, profitable gold Oscar statuette that it gave to Vice President Al Gore 2 years ago for his environmental movie, An Inconvenient Truth. They say the Oscar helped elevate the Tennessean's profile to win the Nobel Peace Prize, despite his embarrassing loss to the moronic George W. Bush in the 2000 election. So old Al Gore has made quite a bit of dough toting around that Oscar. And here's some members of the Academy who say we should take it back. It's all been a scam. Any more on the climate here? Do we want to do more on the climate? Christopher Horner, a fellow with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, this is a report from Fox News, has given NASA until the end of the year to grant his two-year-old Freedom of Information Act request for research detailing NASA's climate data and explaining why the agency has altered its own figures. Horner said he suspects NASA's information is highly damaging to the anthropogenic. What did I say? Anthropogenic global warming and all that. I can't hardly say that, for crying out loud. But White House scientists defended the science behind global warming on Capitol Hill last week. Yeah, they're having hearings, and they're all backing and filling on that. And I'm looking forward to, perhaps, a year from now, being able to report to you that the religion of the worship of science, 2010 was the year that that religion cracked. It's the Weekly Worldview. I am your host, Doug McBurney. And I think the pipes are going to hold out for the last segment here, but bear with me. From the Culture File, ABC has canceled two more Adam Lambert appearances, one on Jimmy Kimmel Live and one on New Year's Rockin' Eve. On his Twitter account, young Adam wrote, quote, "Yes, sadly, friends, ABC has canceled my appearances on Kimmel and New Year's Eve," and then he has a little sad face, you know, a colon with a little parenthesis sad face. He says, "Don't blame them. It's the FCC heat." Oh, I just love saying FCC. It's one of my favorite words, FCC. It's the FCC heat. I am doing Leno, though. Bad choice of words there. I am doing Leno, though, and looking into something for New Year's Eve. It'll all blow over. Let's focus on being positive. And then he has a little smiley face with the colon and the parentheses, smiley. Now, Disney ABC Television Group President Ann Sweeney recently said the company was revealing the steps it takes to vet live performances and plans to contractually obligate artists to match their stage shows to their rehearsals. Wonderful. Wonderful way to solve the problem, Ann. Anyway, she says, quote, "We certainly don't want to suppress artistry at any level. But we also have to be very cognizant of who our audience is." There is so much wrong with that statement, I don't know where to begin. Artistry at any level, Anne? Artistry at any level? What if the performance includes the beheading of a Jew? Would you want to suppress that type of artistry? Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's street performance? At any level? Any level, Anne, really? And she says we need to be cognizant of who our audience is. And I just want to remind Anne that there's one person in your audience who's watching everything you put on TV. His name is Jesus Christ, and he is in the audience, Anne. And on Judgment Day, you will give an account for every idol performance that crosses your studio. Okay? I hope you can understand big words with lots of syllables, Anne. Be cognizant of who your audience is. That is an important realization on behalf of ABC there. I'm not sure she understands what she just said there, but hopefully we can point her in the right direction. All right, we're running out of time. From the Culture File, Lake Placid, New York. Do I want to do this? Let's see. John Brown, the 19th century abolitionist who advocated armed violence, drew a diverse crowd last week to study how his fight against slavery continues to play in America. Organizer Naj Wyckoff said, quote, "We're trying to get people to take a look at the use of violence in our country, why American culture uses violence to achieve an end." Brown, by the way, I know why I wanted to do this. Brown was hanged for treason on December 2nd, 1859 at Charlestown in Virginia, a few miles from Harper's Ferry, where he led an ill-fated raid on the federal arsenal earlier that fall. Now, his attack failed, but it pushed the nation closer to the Civil War that erupted nearly 2 years later. Brown's raid began on October 16, 1859, when his force of 21 armed men took hostages inside the Harper's Ferry arsenal. The bloody assault ended 2 days later when U.S. Marines, led by Robert E. Lee, captured a wounded Brown and 10 of his followers. Brown went on trial that month, was convicted of treason, and was executed that same month. Now, shouldn't Hassan, the Fort Hood killer, shouldn't he be tried for treason and hung? I mean, he shot 13, and I believe one of the women was pregnant. He murdered 14 people on an army base, and he's an army major. Does that not qualify for treason? Can somebody help me here? Does that not qualify? If you're in the army and you shoot and kill your fellow soldiers, have we all lost our minds? I don't think I have heard a single official even mention the word treason in the case of Abu Nidal Hassan or whatever his name is. The Muslim enemy combatant. He is treasonous. All right, let's see. I don't want to do anything on the healthcare. I just don't care. Well, let's see. Stephanie Gray is a Canadian anti-abortion activist from the Personhood File. During a sparsely attended lecture delivered at Columbia University in November entitled Echoes of the Holocaust, Stephanie Gray told her audience that the systematic nature of killings was seen in Auschwitz then and in abortion now. Centers are set up for the express purpose of terminating lives where women come and their children are dismembered. In another address at a Canadian university, she reportedly told her audience that denying full personhood to embryos, such as those used in stem cell research, was analogous to denying full personhood to Jews during the Shoah. Wow. Gray does not merely argue that both are moral wrongs, or that the lessons of the Holocaust can shed light on a contemporary debate. Instead, she actually argues that the two are moral equivalents. Wow. Stephanie Gray, Canadian pro-life activist, gets it. You could say that they're moral equivalents, but during the Holocaust, there were only about 9 million people murdered. There's been nearly 1.5 billion abortions since legalization began back in the 60s and 70s worldwide. Approaching 1.5 billion. So moral equivalent? Morally equivalent, yes, but the death toll has been much higher in the abortion Holocaust. Let's see. The guy who writes this article, he disagrees with her. His name's Jacob Apple, and he posted this on the Huffington Post. He says, "One can certainly believe that fetuses have inherent value without believing that a Holocaust is occurring. By analogy, I view capital punishment as a grave moral wrong. But I don't think one can reasonably compare governors who signed death warrants to the guards who carried off Anne Frank. While the overwhelming majority of people oppose the torture of animals, very few consider such deeds to be as immoral as the systematic torture and murder of human beings. Although many women died from septic abortions in the pre-Roe v. Wade era, and many more would perish if abortion were recriminalized, you never hear supporters of reproductive freedom describing the victims of botched back-alley abortions as Holocaust victims." And I would just state to Mr. Apple, that's because none of the examples you just cited are even remotely analogous. Not even remotely. In fact, your characterization should not even be on the same page with Stephanie Gray's, because her analogies were coherent and pertinent and cogent and very well done. You, on the other hand, sir, are an intellectual scoundrel. Let's see. I'm going to have to go quickly here. The U.S. is funding more stem cell research in the spirit of the Holocaust. They're slaughtering more innocent people and then using their body parts to make skincare lotions for old ladies. Unbelievable. Meredith Baxter Birney has come out as a lesbian. She's been married 3 times. She has 5 kids. Her partner Nancy is a building contractor. So we know who wears the pants in that relationship. We know who wears the overalls in that relationship. Let's see. The war file, Bin Laden, has apparently been spotted. Possibly. Let's see. According to a detainee, he says, in 2009, in January or February, I met this friend of mine. He said he had come from a meeting with Sheikh Osama, and he could arrange for me to meet him as well. He helps Al-Qaeda people coming from other countries to get to the Sheikh, so he can advise them on whatever they're planning for Europe or other places. The Sheikh doesn't stay in any one place, but this guy, this friend of mine, he came from Ghazni, so I think that's where the Sheikh was. Yes, will you please let me go now? All right. So anyway, U.S. intelligence officials are taking this seriously. The ghost of Osama bin Laden in, where was it? Ghazni. Yeah. Let's get some Marines into Ghazni so we can find Osama. Let's see. Okay, Obama has announced that Afghanistan will be no Vietnam. Made a speech at West Point. Boy, you could feel the tension in that room, huh? Here we go. There is a new line of ecstasy pills made in the image of Barry Ho, according to Texas police. Texas police who have snatched a whole batch of ecstasy pills shaped like the head of Barack Obama. Police in Palmview, Texas, detained a driver after finding black tar heroin, cocaine, marijuana, and several ecstasy pills in the back of his car. The drugs, the police say, look like vitamins for kids. Well, what more can you say about that? Putin says he's not leaving power. He says, don't hold your breath. He made the comment with his trademark smirk. At which point the interviewer did hold his breath for fear of poison gas. What to end with here? The SEALs. 2 Navy SEALs accused of punching one of the insurgents responsible for killing several contractors. Let's see. They were arraigned in military court on Monday. Yeah. Petty Officer First Class Julio Huertes and Petty Officer Second Class Matthew McCabe. They say they punched the detainee in the midsection and may have given him a bloody lip. Yeah. Anyway, they could have accepted non-judicial punishment, but they want a court-martial so they can clear their name, and I think so they can show the insanity of the military brass leading our boys into the slaughter in the Middle East to prop up Muslim regimes. Dateline New York City from Fox TV. New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn got angry and tearful at a news conference Thursday when asked about the failure of the gay marriage bill in the state Senate. She said there are 60 plus people in that room, and they're the ones with a job to do. They're the ones who failed, not anyone else. Today, the New York State Senate rejected an opportunity to declare that all citizens in New York are equal. The depths of sadness that I and many New Yorkers feel today is difficult to express. This is a loss for every family in New York. This is a loss for every lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender New Yorker. Okay. That was the New York Student Council Speaker Christine Quinn. And that's the Weekly Worldview for this week. I'll be back with you next week. I want to thank KGov, Denver Bible Church, Personage USA, American Right to Life, Theology Online, and of course my other brother Daryl, who makes it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios. And I will be back with you next week. Until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.